Hey everybody, my name is Mike Gibbs. I run accountsrecovery.net and I'm excited to be here moderating today's webinar on data breaches, how to keep your name out of the headlines. The recent news of a data breach at a collection agency that has compromised the personal and financial information of millions of people has put a spotlight on the information security practices of companies in the credit and collection industry. On very short notice, I'm incredibly lucky and fortunate and grateful to have a panel of leading data and information security experts with me today to share their tips and insights into how collection agencies should approach information security and the fundamentals of securing their data. This webinar is being generously sponsored by InterPros. You'll get the chance to hear about them a little later in our program. I want to take a quick second and say a few words about accountsrecovery.net. Accountsrecovery.net is a news and information platform for the RM industry. The site publishes unique and curated content, maintains a number of email newsletters, hosts webinars like this one, and offers a number of exciting podcasts for the RM industry. The site is free for everyone in the industry to use and is a great resource of news and insights to help educate and inform. I hope you'll all spend a few minutes every day checking out what it's got to offer. Now, let me tell you a little bit about today's speakers. Brian Albertson is the Chief Information Officer at Harris & Harris, where he leads the IT organization and has responsibility over day-to-day IT operations, as well as data security. He possesses more than 17 years of IT experience, much of that focused on the accounts receivable management space, working for some of the largest companies in the industry, in addition to being data security and IT consultant. Brian focuses on process automation, as well as making sure his organization is building technology solutions to increase efficiencies while reducing risk and overall costs. Jonathan Harbin is the Chief Information Officer at Frost Arnett. Jonathan and his team are responsible for managing the ever-increasing amount of data flowing through the company. Before joining Frost Arnett, Jonathan worked in technology-related fields at Nashville-based healthcare companies for more than 10 years. Jonathan earned a bachelor's degree in information technology from Middle Tennessee State University and is a certified information systems security professional. Matt Kiefer is the Chief Officer for Information Development and Compliance for the Preferred Group of Tampa. He is a past president and current vice president and education chair of the Florida Collectors Association. He served on the board of the National Healthcare Collections Association, was a member of HFMA and MGMA, and is also an ACA scholar and fellow. He's been in healthcare and collections since 2001. Jeremy Mates is founder and president of Mates Consulting, which is one of the very few vendors previously endorsed by ACA International as the preferred vendor and senior executive to Agent Z LLC. Jeremy has more than 25 years experience in the RM industry, has successfully headed operations and technologies for companies from large to small, and has consulted to and supported well over 100 collection agencies and creditors on technology, automation, telephony, operations, and information security management, as well as consulting directly to multiple receivable software vendors. With more than 15 years of IT and cybersecurity experience focused on the RM space, Michael Wright is one of the industry's leading cybersecurity experts. Most recently, Michael served as the Chief Security Officer for TechLock, a firm specializing in financial services and healthcare cybersecurity consultants. He has spent the past decade assisting many of the industry's leading agencies reduce their cybersecurity risk, improve their security posture, and ensure compliance with a myriad of applicable laws and regulations. Today, he is a cybersecurity evangelist at large and is uniquely qualified to help organizations address the cybersecurity threat of tomorrow. The format for today's webinar will be a panel discussion. We encourage everybody to submit questions and we'll get to them when the discussion has concluded or as the discussion is ongoing, depending on the questions. To submit a question, please enter it into the question tab on your Zoom webinar control panel. This event is being recorded, and a recording will be made available later today on accountsrecovery.net. Finally, I just want to ask everyone to take a minute and fill out the survey that should pop up on your screen after the webinar is over today. You'll also receive a link via email tomorrow to access the survey. Participating in the survey helps me develop content that's what you're looking for and make sure we get the speakers that you want to hear from. With that, let's launch into today's discussion. So, as collection agencies use more technology, are they becoming more vulnerable to attacks and breaches? That's the first discussion topic for today. Brian, maybe you can weigh in with your thoughts first.
Sure. I think it's a multifaceted kind of question. I think the first thing that, you know, specifically that we do and that I've also done on the data security side of things is really trying to map out where data goes. So an example would be like a data flow diagram, trying to understand, you know, at each point throughout that data's life cycle where it lives. And as you look at the different technologies you use, what data becomes used or prevalent in the usage of those technologies to determine what your overall risks are. So for example, you know, things that are coming to the forefront that more and more agencies are using are things like text-based approaches, something where there's like a live agent, SMS type, in addition to SMS, but IM capabilities, and then of course the payment portals and other things. So more of the automated or agentless approaches. You always have to look and see, you know, what risks are associated with those technologies, and then what type of data is used in them.
This is Mike. That's a good point, Brian. I'd like to add on to that just a little bit. So, I mean, the cat's out of the bag in terms of the internet, right? Not many collection agencies are using a Rolodex or a green screen, you know, dumb terminal. Everything is network connected. Everything's internet connected. And a collection agency, just like any other business, you want to be more efficient in your collections, as efficient as possible to make money. So that's going to mean using new technologies. So, you know, I guess in short, my answer is yes, but using new technologies is probably going to introduce additional vulnerabilities into your business. Payment portals, IVRs, dialers, data warehouse, chat bots that can negotiate settlements, that all sort of thing. But those types of technologies are also going to help you help your business make more money, be more efficient. So I think it's just a matter of being cognizant of the types of threats that these new technologies will introduce into your organization and just addressing those risks appropriately.
Yeah, I agree. And I would just say that, you know, a lot of these technologies are being purchased through other vendors. And so a strong vendor management program where you're vetting the risk versus the opportunity that these vendors provide is absolutely essential these days for all agencies.
This is Matt. I'll just add that, just like they said before, I think each new avenue of technology, you just got to treat it like a door. Make sure that door has a lock and a monitor. You know, just like in high school, you didn't get to walk through the hallways free without a hall pass. And if you didn't have a hall pass, you were stopped. And that's how you have to treat all these avenues of technology.
A good way to start the discussion. So I'm curious, you know, there's still, we know some details about what's gone on at the collection agency that's been the subject of the breach, and we kind of know a little bit, but there's still a ton we don't know. So I'm curious, even though it's only been a week or so, what should companies in the ARM industry take away from the news of this data breach?
This is Matt.
Mike, right?
I'd like to say, I think it's a good time to start a gap analysis at your agency. I mean, from reviewing your BAAs to make sure they've been updated with the latest provisions from the High Tech Act, make sure they're current, and as well as your any subcontractor you use, you got to make sure the BAAs are compliant. And it's a good time to also review your responsibilities under that contract to notify and cure. And don't forget that, as well as your contractors that are basically held to the same standard that you are. And you want to make sure that you're receiving the minimum necessary information to complete your job. Are you getting too much information? You don't want to have too much exposure out there. And one of the things I think that's real important is, you know, there's state guidelines that out there now that are more stringent than HIPAA or High Tech Act. You might need to notify your state AG, or there might be a media policy or something in place. And I think those are some good starts.
Yeah, I agree. And I would say that one thing that anybody that has a payment portal or payment solution through their software, make sure that it uses irreversible tokenization. I know that's a big tech buzzword, but the PCI, the payment card industry, says that either tokenization should be used or encryption. The thing is, the encryption requires you to do it in about 20 different places. Whereas if you can do tokenization, it's much, much easier than having to do all of the other requirements under PCI. And that tokenization actually removes the credit card information from your system. So if you're using a payment solution that doesn't currently do that, I would switch to someone who does.
Yeah, this is Mike. And another thing that I would bring up is many companies get audited. You get audited by your clients. You may have to go out and get a third-party auditor company to come certify you against a standard like PCI or HITRUST or HIPAA or any of those other ones out there, some of which have certifications, other ones don't. But there's also a method that you can use to get a better actual test of your organization's security posture. If you go out and hire a cybersecurity firm to do a penetration test where they're actually trying to hack into your payment portal, or they're trying to social engineer your employees to try to get access to your accounting system or your company's checking account or your collections database, that's a really good way if you find a good firm that can do decent work to get a better picture of your actual security posture and to see what you're actually vulnerable against versus just checking a box to see if you're compliant with one standard or another.
And this is Brian. I'll jump in and add a few other things. I mean, ultimately, data security comes down to risk management. And there's multiple ways of looking at that. Mike just mentioned a few with doing, a third-party audit. There's definitely plenty of experts out there that are qualified to do penetration testing, vulnerability scanning, and those things. In terms of, what companies should also look at, I mean, part of the first thing is it's much easier to attack a system that's public-facing. So what are the list of all your public-facing systems? And that's either something that maybe you host and manage or that you're paying a vendor to do, like a payment portal vendor, somebody that's hosting your IVR or other product. But even reading some of the information about this particular data breach, and if you've read any of the articles, I mean, there's things that you have to do in the event that you have a breach. So do you have cyber insurance coverage? Is that something that your company should look at doing? And what does that coverage entail and being familiar with that? And then we'll get into some of the incident management portions of that topic. But those are a couple other key things to look at.
This is Matt. I just wanted to add, there's some often overlooked things, I think, that we just become the status quo and we don't look at them. But things like, your facility access, have you had employees that have left? Have you changed the door code or key card access? Have you changed their password? And most importantly, have you terminated their access, to, for instance, your systems and your client systems? I think you should also review things like your workstation access. And if you use products like TeamViewer, make sure that updates, security patches and things are done, because those things also offer an environment that where you're exposed as well and carry their own inherent risks. Just in general, security patches and updates, who's responsible for that? Make sure that they're done, but more importantly, who follows up on that person? You gotta make sure, number one, if you had a breach, can you prove you did all these things? Even if you have a policy and procedure in place, can you really actually prove that you followed and your policies and procedures were actually followed? Or like they said, do you need to hire an outside firm or a consultant to provide, some kind of service if you don't have the resources on your own or the technical expertise? And I think you also need to review audit logs of your system use and look for things like, unauthorized access from unusual IP addresses if you have people that access your system away, or you have clients basically that access your system. Are there any other accesses coming from different IPs? And then the other things to consider if for collection software or multi-factor authentication, do you have that set up? Is it logical to set it up? Or maybe just for your clients that have access to your system? Your electronic file security processes and protocols to sending the files to make sure those are sent. This is a really good time to do a very thorough gap analysis, especially as we learn more and more. That this is, these are critical factors that can affect the vulnerability and your company's existence or ability to continue to exist.
Excellent. Well, at this point, before we move on to our next discussion topic, I want to pause the discussion briefly, and I'd like to introduce Aaron Ryder from Interpros. the sponsor of today's webinar, to say a few words. Aaron?
Thanks, Mike. And thank you to all the panelists today. It's a full boat of panelists, Matt, Jeremy, Jonathan, Brian, and Mike. We're all reading the same article about the industry data breach, and when Gib put out the call for a webinar sponsor, we were all over it. Data privacy and associated compliance auditing is a significant expenditure for Interpros. So we're very keen to learn what precipitated the last security breach. We're also well aware that the topic is filled with arcane terminology and descriptions that make non-IT people's eyes glaze over, which is most of us. So in that lies the challenge for us as a company to communicate to a market that needs to know the consumer and client data they hold is safe in a way that's comforting and assuring without simply saying, trust us, we got you covered. As our panelists will likely touch upon at some point during this discussion, the opportunities and norms for data and application hosting have changed drastically in the last few years. And we've been leveraging those improvements here at Interpros in hardware security, flexibility, compliance, and redundancy over the last decade with our web-based debt collection software platform, ACE. Not only can we scale our service with a company's growth or contraction at the click of a button, but our customers inherit an impressive list of audit certifications from both AWS facilities and our own third-party SOC, PCI, and pen test audits on our customers' server instances. In addition to hardware security, we facilitate process security like, even IP white labeling, tokenization, as it was mentioned, multi-factor authentication or single sign-on registry integrations that add more layers of security to thwart any compromised user login info. See? Glazed eyes. As I said earlier, we spend a great deal of time and money on this every year for those annual certifications. But at Interpros, we consider ourselves a service company, and we happen to make fantastic software for debt recovery. Our relationship with our customers, our partnerships, because if they're not happy, we're not either. And it's why our service subscription includes open marketplace to third-party tech with all security compliance rules associated, monthly updates and upgrades to the software, real-time data and document backups, and probably most importantly, responsive support. But we are devoted to supporting the debt recovery market. It's all we do, and we're pretty great at it. So if you're concerned about your data security profile, you want to modernize your operation, or just looking for a better relationship with your software provider, we look forward to hearing from you. And you can find us at interpros.com. It's interprose.com. Thanks, Mike.
Awesome. Thank you, Aaron. And thanks again to Interpros for sponsoring today's webinar. Like Aaron said, very short notice. I think this all came about starting last Thursday. So I really appreciate their support for something that's a very important topic. Curious, I'd like to raise the discussion or the conversation of buy versus build when it comes to different systems. I know there are pros and cons to both. I'm curious maybe if there's a sort of if you have a general opinion on one or the other, or if there's sort of specific questions that maybe somebody should ask if they're considering buying or building a system or a component to a system. Maybe that might be helpful in that decision-making process. Maybe that might be something you'd want to raise instead. But I'd like to hear from everybody, if you don't mind. Jeremy, would you mind going first?
Sure. Can you hear me, Mike? I wasn't sure if you could hear me earlier.
Yeah, all good.
Okay, great. Yeah, so when we're looking at different vendors, especially when it comes to software, one of the big things that's changing in the industry now, because technology in the last 10 years, it advances, but it hasn't advanced heavily. But one thing that has advanced is cloud systems and the way software such as your collection software handles data going out. In particular, on our mind today would be like payment data. It was interesting in the article, if you read it closely, that even though it was under a HIPAA breach, it was the financial data that had been targeted. And it looked like from the article that they were most likely, the agency was hosting their website, which gave them greater liability of threat. Today, we can, in a lot of cases, and even the collection softwares are outsourcing that liability from their software or through their software from retaining that data on the local systems. And what I mean by that is, and back in the day, used to be if you took a credit card and your collection software is advanced enough, you would put it in, it would retain it locally, and then, of course, you had the liability of guarding your systems. Today, more and more collection software, whether it be Interpros, Ontario Systems, or whoever, is going to a process by which they're passing that information and not retaining it. The first thing I look at if I was looking at new collection software, I would find out how they're holding that data, if they're mitigating the process of payment. If they're not, if you're using a third-party vendor for mitigating the payment process directly, I would check with them, and I would look to see if they have big pockets, and I would make sure that I have a business partner agreement with them so that the liability would transfer. If you look closely at that article, they said later in the article that, or at least the one I was reading, to some degree that they had since then moved their payment portal to a third-party vendor. So that was them mitigating their risk, their liability. So next time if somebody gets invaded, it won't be them. They will point to their business partner, and their business partner will take the liability. They may have a diligence to report, but it won't be them that broke it. And they won't be hit as hard, both probably financially, but as far as their the way people see them in the industry is how they're handling that. So one thing to consider is, where is your data stored? What are you storing on your local systems? Because, credit cards are a big thing. That's what people are looking for. Socials would probably be next. I was funny, the article I read, they said, but at least the lab information didn't get, spread. It's like, well, if somebody found out about my lab and my sugar was high, who cares, right? You know, really what we're worried about is our financial and our Social Security data. So that's where I say to look first is when you talk to your different companies, in particular software companies, look to ask them how the data is going to be transferred, or if you're going to use them for electronic payment transference, where is it going to be stored, especially if you're doing repetitive payments, and what's your liability there, and then what they're going to guarantee as far as if they have a data breach. Do they have something in place to mitigate that process and how they're going to handle it?
This is Mike. Just something to add on to that is if you're really considering doing it yourself, building your own payment processing website, for example, in-house, you really have to do it right. And that's where a lot of the smaller and mid-sized companies fall flat. In order to securely develop this type of software, you need, not just somebody's nephew who learned coding in school, but you need at least two individuals who have been trained in secure development and who can review each other's code and can do a whole bunch of the stuff on the technical side that we don't really need to get into. But it's a very involved process just to make sure that you do it right. Larger organizations can afford to have a team of developers working on this. And in a case like that, they probably can benefit from the flexibility of having a custom in-house developed software. But for smaller, mid-sized companies, speaking purely from a combination of a cost as well as from a risk and practical security perspective, I almost always recommend to people who ask me that you go out and you work with a well-established third-party vendor that has years of experience in developing and rolling out these sort of payment platforms, because otherwise you're probably just asking for trouble.
Yeah, I agree. It comes back to the build it versus buy it. Trying to get the type of developers that Mike was talking about is not cheap. And many of these vendors that have built trusted solutions that many other people have been using for years, they go through rigorous processes, spending hundreds of thousands of dollars per year to get their payment application PCI certified. Unless you're a very large company, it doesn't make sense to try and build that yourself.
And this is Brian. I think sitting in the CIO seat, I mean, you have to look at what your core competencies are. Are you a software development company? Is that the game you really want to get into? Or do you want to go find, appropriate vendors to fulfill your service needs? And we talked about it earlier about, due diligence and the vendor management component, or that you integrate in your vendor management process, do the third-party due diligence in the case of a payment portal or web payment solution, validating that, their report on compliance, which is associated with the PCI DSS standard, that vendor goes through that audit, in most cases, you're hoping that it's third-party based on the volume of credit card transactions, but that you're putting the onus on them to validate that they go through the compliance process, they have the development expertise in place. And it was mentioned a few minutes ago about tokenization, which is a good point. I mean, you can integrate your solution, your system of record, whatever that system of record is, just by building an API, an application programming interface with, you know, maybe that payment vendor, where you can tokenize that data and you can exchange payments that are made on a web portal back to your system of record, where you really don't have to be the system expert, the software developer.
Just in that, I concur with all of what was said, and not a shameless plug for Interpros to sponsor this, but, you know, we use their software and we also use Repay as a payment processor, and the two are integrated. So it's my understanding that, you know, when we talk about all these different audit processes and layers and stuff like, you know, SSA 18 and SAS 70 and PCI DSS compliance, HIPAA, et cetera, that you inherit, or an agency like mine who is to adopt that collection software platform, you basically inherit all of those security compliance certificates and certifications by virtue of using their product and the fact that they have to go through it. Not just that, but for instance, Interpros uses the Amazon web platform. I think it's AWS or something like that. But, you know, Amazon's a huge company. It has a lot of liability and exposure. So, you know, they're going to be on their game when it comes to security and compliance. So, you know, just by nature of a smaller agency, not having the resources to, you know, like you said, have their own programmers and test and keep doing this quarterly, if not more frequently, it helps to have a company like that do it for you. And basically, you know, not that you can always feel 100% secure, but maybe 99.8% confidence level. So that's my take on it.
Okay, excellent. We did get a question in from the audience, so I want to ask that because it's kind of what we're talking about, but also to use it as a reminder to ask anybody, if you have a question for any of the panel, you can type it into your Zoom webinar control panel, and we'll get it asked before the end of the conversation today. The question is, I hear about agencies using an import-export process to take payments outside of their core software application versus using an integrated solution. What are your thoughts about this practice?
This is Matt. For reasons of what I said before, I would prefer my payment processor to be fully integrated with my collection software. Not to say you can't protect it and do it the right way, but I don't want to have that exposure, unneeded exposure, and keep me up at night more than I am now. So that's why my preference would be to have a payment processor that is fully integrated with my collection software.
And this is Jeremy. I want to handle that question a little bit more as well. When you talk about importing and exporting payments from your core software application, there's questions that you have to understand there as running your business. Are you retaining that credit card information on your system? Or is when you process that export down to your payment vendor a flat file as opposed to going through a direct web connection or portal? You know, how are those processes going? Are you using an SSFTP connection? Are you removing that data on your system? Because if you think of PCI and what they talk about scope, you know, is the scope of the financial data still retained within your system, or are you, when you move that out, are you getting rid of it? Because if it's retained in your system, now you have to beef up your security and know, and there's a higher responsibility to that security, just like HIPAA data. You have a higher responsibility to secure that data and the file in between. Are you storing that on a secondary server? How is that server out there in the system? So there's more liability involved and there's more responsibility. My biggest thing is get a third party involved, whatever you do, because if you're setting up with a third party for payments and then with their business agreement, I would get a third party or have them provide a third party that's checked out their process to determine that it is secure. A lot of them will come with it. They'll have some certification from some organization and third party that they can provide to you right away. And that would be one question I'd always ask.
Yeah, and I guess I would say that we do use an import-export process. And part of that reason is that, you know, it reduces the risk of if that payment processor is breached, we can limit the amount of information that is available in that breach to the bare minimum needed to take payments. So you could, you know, use an import-export that basically sends account number, maybe name and balance, and maybe zip code just to identify that person. And that way, even if there is a breach, you're very, very limited in your exposure. So we have chosen to actually separate that from our system for that reason.
Good. Appreciate the information. Thanks for the question. We've talked a little bit about agencies working with multiple vendor partners. I'm curious if you have any insights or advice as to how an agency should make sure that all those partners are working together. And the idea that popped into my head when I came up with this question was, you know, a pharmacist sort of making sure that the different drugs being taken by an individual don't necessarily interact negatively with one another. Is that a possibility with regards to different partners? And how do you sort of address that or overcome that or deal with that?
This
Does anyone want to tackle that one first?
Yeah, this is Mike. I'd like to take that. So Brian Albertson mentions in, I think, one of his first responses, the importance of knowing where your data flows. This is not just within your organization, but it's also how your data flows to your own vendor partners, your own third-party service providers, and how it flows all the way down the chain. Your own vendors might, in their turn, use vendors as well, and they may use vendors, and your data may be either being sent to or being accessed by multiple parties down this chain. So just understanding from start to finish your data flow, not just within your organization, but within your vendor partners as well, is a big help there.
Yeah, and this is Brian. I'll jump back in and talk about that. One of the things that we try to do very hard, and it's very difficult for companies that have had longstanding relationships with vendors. You know, one, it's usually the status quo. Two, many companies haven't really gone through a more arduous vendor management process, although the times are coming, things are changing. I'm sure everyone on this call, your clients are starting to push you at a higher level of due diligence than they ever have. They're starting to ask some of these questions about where do you send our data. So in the same fashion where Mike was just alluding to the data flow process, you know, part of that, you know, is building a vendor management program and knowing how to ask the right questions. And Mike's right, you know, lots of people in this industry leverage skip vendors to do various different things. Well, you know, when you start interacting with those vendors, they may send your data somewhere else. So as an example to what Mike was saying is just make sure that you ask those questions about if I send you these data elements or this data, what happens to that data downstream? And it's usually just not a third party vendor that you're dealing with. There's a fourth or fifth or sixth party somewhere involved. You have to understand the whole chain of custody of that data that you're sending.
This is Matt. I'd like to just add into that one piece. You know, sometimes the simplest thing can be right in front of our eyes. So your payment processor may be secure, your collection software may be secure, but whether, you know, if you use a dialer system or an IVR or even a VoIP system, if you're recording that call, are you blanking out those points in the conversation where credit card information is taken, or is it stored on a recording? You know, some of the most trivial things you got to think about.
Is that just an experience thing? You know, like you're talking about so many different things to think about. I mean, is that one of those things where you kind of have to go through it to know what questions to ask, or, you know, is there a spot, so, you know, how do you sort of figure out what questions you need to ask, I guess, until you need to ask them, maybe?
I think it's sort of a mindset thing more than an experiencing. This is Mike. If you kind of think of yourself as a detective, no question is you know, too dumb or too stupid to ask in these types of scenarios. If you don't fully understand how your data is being transferred and processed, then you just need to ask questions until you do, or you know, make sure that it's explained in a way that you understand.
Yeah, and I would add too that that we have partnered with the FBI. They're more than willing to come in and help you with the questions you don't know. They'll come in and tell you all the different possibilities and the different ways that they've seen other companies breach, maybe things that you would have never thought of. So I would say partner with them. They do that for free.
And keep in mind, go ahead.
Okay.
I was just going to say, you know, just to everyone's benefit, I mean, the information security and components of that are part of your organization's, you know, framework or methodology. I mean, it's not just an IT initiative. It's an organizational initiative. So back to the, you know, asking questions about how business processes work. I mean, that's something that is a problem that IT can't solve on their own. They have to partner with other business units, and making sure that the initiatives are supported from the top down are really important to making sure that your ability to protect the data is being done correctly.
This is Jeremy. Along those lines, you know, it started in the corporations with Sarbanes-Oxley, the ones that were public corporations, that there was a requirement of diligence that the president or the managing members of a company had to be aware of their security and had to take responsibility for it. And that's never fully transferred over to the private sector, non-public corporations. But I would recommend that as times change and more laws get put into place, it'll probably follow suit. So if you don't know what you need, and not everybody knows everything they need, some people think they know everything they need, it's great to partner with experts that are out there, like some people on this phone. But at the same time, I would always recommend looking to a standard, like an information security management standard. One that's one of my favorites is ISO 27001, that's ever changing. But what it does is it gives you a laundry list of things to look for in your environment, not just physically, but also through human communication, through hard storage, through your center, so that way you can go to that list and say, you know, have you thought of this? Have you assessed the risk in that area? And if not, you know, now it tells me I need to know more. If I can't research what those answers are directly, or I don't have time to, let me bring in somebody that can, that's gone through this and done that, so that way you can actually measure your risk. And that's going to be something asked more by companies, is have you measured your risk? And if you have, how? Give us the layout. Give us, you know, how you did a risk measurement, risk assessment, and what did that result in? How do you know you're secure? Where are your weaker areas? If you can't explain that, that may actually put you out of the running to get some vendor relationships and client relationships set up. For an example, Debt Trader, for those that are debt buyers out there, they have a level of requirement now that you must have some type of management system in place and be able to prove it, that you have a management system in place that takes into account things like security and risk, and before they'll even let you on their platform to buy debt. So it's becoming more and more common that you need that ability. And even the security expert looks to somebody else to get the current information. So I would always be asking those questions and looking to a standard to be able to go down the list. ITIL, there's several different ones out there that you can use for standards, but you know, that would be where I would start.
Excellent. I think RMA's got an information security component to its certification as well. So it's another spot that people might be able to look at is RMA International if they're looking for information. Moving on to the next topic, I'm curious in the week since the first breach was announced, there've been two other companies have announced that they were also affected by it. But since the news was released, I'm curious, those of you who are working at an agency, you know, Brian, Jonathan, Matt, have you done anything? You know, have you taken any extra steps? Have you asked any questions in that week? And if, you know, maybe Jeremy and Mike, you know, could you offer any advice or the questions that agencies should be asking, or you know, areas they should be looking at to see if they're, you know, possibly in a similar boat?
Yeah, hey, Mike, this is John. I would say the biggest thing that I've done in the wake of this is it's a great opportunity to raise awareness. It's sad that it takes an event like this to remind everyone, but a lot of people think that this won't happen to me or that we're too small, things like that, that, you know, just kind of take that risk. This is a good example to remind yourself and to be vigilant and make sure that cybersecurity is something that you're important and that you discuss, you know, at the executive level.
Mike, this is Matt. One of the things, obviously, you know, when I contacted you and I reached out, ever since then, we've been just doing due diligence and a thorough gap analysis. I don't want to rehash what I talked about before, but I know you'll make this presentation as an audio available to people who either missed it or want to go back and review it. But just a thorough gap analysis and review all of your points, your doors that have exposure, and make sure you audit them and just refine your processes.
This is Mike. There's one thing I'd add. So although I'm not working at an agency, I do see the results of data breaches both within our industry and within others as well. And one thing a lot of you may have noticed from these headlines, and they go back to the Equifax breach and before, is how long it seems that these organizations were compromised. You know, they were compromised for 3 months, 6 months, 12 months, 18 months before they even figured out or somebody told them that they were breached. So one thing that I would recommend as an action item to take away for any agency is going to be, number one, here's a key word to learn. It's called indicators of compromise. These types of attacks don't happen in a vacuum. Something that works at one company, some attack, you know, the same people or different people are going to try that attack at somewhere else. So if you think about indicators of compromise, things like, you know, a large amount of data has been transferred out of your network. Oh man, maybe somebody is uploading your database to somewhere, those sorts of things. Making sure that you actually have the tools in place and the people in place to monitor those types of indicators so that you can find out day one that there's a potential issue. And doing this can help limit the impact of a breach because you can limit the amount of data that actually gets stolen from your organization.
Now, I would add on to that too, that the U.S. government offers a free service, U.S. CERT, they call it, the Computer Emergency Response Team, and they send out daily alerts to talk about what kind of attacks are being seen, which ones are being successful, which ones they think you might see soon. Have at least one person in your organization that's receiving those and reviewing those daily. They'll, you know, specify certain vendors and certain pieces of hardware so that you can, you know, you see something that you use, a certain piece of hardware that you have in your company. If there's a vulnerability, that's the wake-up call to make sure and go patch that immediately.
And this is Brian. The other thing I would add to that line of thinking is a large percentage of breaches are based on known vulnerabilities. Do you have a vulnerability management program? How often, and similar to the US CERT emails that come out, a lot of those talk to, you know, vulnerability in one software package or another. Very frequently, they're things that every organization uses. Everyone seemingly uses like a Google Chrome or a Firefox or a Java or Adobe PDF Reader or something along those lines. Do you have mechanisms in place to keep those software packages up to date so that you're essentially, within a very short period of time, able to resolve or close those vulnerability holes by patching solutions? I mean, most people run Microsoft operating systems. There's readily available solutions out there that can help you automate that patch management process. And there's plenty of third-party tools that can help you patch those other products that are not Microsoft-based, some of the ones I just mentioned.
You know, unfortunately, collection agencies aren't really sort of allowed to kind of have a closed air gap system where they're not allowed to, you know, access the internet or not sort of have access to any other systems, you know, because of payment processing and, you know, most of these, you know, if you're using a cloud-based or web-based technology or server, but also because clients tend to want access to their information, to their data, to see how their collections are going and their accounts are being handled. So I'm curious, you know, if you think that this breach should open up a conversation about whether agencies should allow client access into their systems, and or at least to the extent that clients should be allowed access to their systems.
This is Jeremy. You know, it was interesting that you bring that up because when I was working for an agency about 10 years ago, go back further, about 20, I'm losing track of time, about 15 years ago. But anyway, what happened was they had clients that did access their system and they accessed their systems. Fortunately, we had competent network administrators that had set in the routers between controls so that they couldn't just come in to one point, any more than one point that we would allow them, and that was secured and monitored. And it was interesting because they ended up getting a virus. It happened to be a hospital. They got a virus in their hospital, shut all their computer systems down, their servers down, everything. And fortunately, we were secure because of the diligence we took with that access point, and it could not get across that access point. But same as people coming into your system, and I know we talk about agencies having to have some type of internet capability, your people are probably one of your greatest risks. I would very much button down who has external email access. I'd very much button down the websites that my staff is, in general, needs to get to, which is what we did at many sites. You know, they may have to do some skip tracing function, or they may have to connect to a remote dialer, but they don't need wide open web access. And it's not because, and sometimes it is because we don't want to look at the football stats, but it's also so that they don't end up going to a rogue site by accident, pulling down a virus or something else on their computer that can compromise our network. And same with email. Email is a nasty source, as we well know, of getting viruses in. So, and I find, when I've done scans of people's offices, it's amazing to me that they're really buttoned up on their network in certain areas, but loose on others. You go down and you find out that the virus scanners on the desktops have not been updated in you know, a year or two. Maybe because a file's not plugging through, maybe it's because they just weren't paying attention to it. But, you know, you've got to keep this comprehensive list, especially when I think at the user level, of everything that they may touch or may touch them that may end up bringing trash with it. So that's something to always watch for.
Yeah, and I would add to that, too, that, I mean, we talk about a lot of these advanced things that we can do, but really it's going back to the basics. Things as simple as password management. If you can, multi-factor authentication is the gold standard. If you can do that with your application, with your logins, then do that. For many of us, you have so many logins to so many different sites and so many different client systems that it's impossible to keep track of all them and all the passwords. So people tend to pick the same simple password and they just use it across all systems. Well, the first thing a hacker is going to do is, you know, have a data breach at Facebook, get your email address and your password, and go try that at every other site they can think. And if you've used the same password on other sites, they're going to be able to get in. So I would recommend using a password manager. None of us can memorize that many separate passwords, so use a piece of software to help you.
This is Matt. I would just add to that, you know, make sure you're educating your employees. A lot of times it'll stay at the management level and not necessarily filter down. But if employees, especially employees that get access or get emails from clients and stuff, any kind of file attachment, if it's not sent securely or something like that, you know, you should have a policy. Don't click it. You can right click on the from and make sure it's really from that organization. It's not a phishing attempt. But generally, I mean, anything that's sent as a link, you know, if you don't trust the source, definitely open it.
Excellent. Good advice. We've only got a few minutes left in our conversation, but I wanted to remind everybody one more time, if you have a question for any of the panelists, please enter it now. That's probably the last chance to get it in front of me so that I can ask it of the panelists before our webinar's up in about 10 minutes or so. Another question I'd like to ask, I'm curious, has cloud-based storage equaled or surpassed on-premises data storage? Wondering if the panel would expand upon the cost savings associated with not being responsible for the hardware in their offices and maybe the additional flexibility that's offered by using a hosted service for data and application hosting. Does anyone want to take that one first? Everyone's thinking
okay, quite, really this is Jeremy. I can take it. With a lot of your small to medium-sized organizations, cloud-based storage tends to be a no-brainer. You know, we used to pay thousands of dollars for everything from tape decks for backups to having to do different things. And there's cloud-based storage and there's system, you know, cloud-based systems. So you have some of the agencies out there that are using a software that's powered through the internet from a provider. And then you have some agencies out there that have a software that they drop on their local desktop or on their server, and they have to maintain and control that. It is a cost savings factor to the small and medium to mitigate that to their provider. for a cloud-based solution in a lot of cases, as long as it doesn't compromise their flexibility to be able to get data to and from their clients and so forth. Usually you'll find a cost savings in adopting cloud-based and then being able to put that business partner agreement in place. So now it's their responsibility to make sure that there's no compromise to the data, that you can point to them if there's any type of issue that comes up. Not that you ever want to, or ever need, hopefully never need to, but that you don't have it be your direct responsibility, that you can actually have those partners take over that process at a fee that's usually very acceptable compared to having to buy your own hardware or software or both.
Yeah, I would agree with Jeremy too. I think the thing that to watch out for is that some of these services are so easy to use that people will feel like they can use them without asking anyone. So, you know, you may like to use Dropbox for your company, but someone else is using Google Drive. Well, you've got a BAA in place with Microsoft, but you didn't even know that someone out here is using Google Drive. It's so easy, and people don't realize that it's a security risk. You know, they can upload sensitive data and have absolutely zero security measures around it sitting out in the cloud. So the term used in the industry for that is shadow IT. And cloud has made that much, much easier, and people don't even realize the security implications. They're just trying to find easier ways to get their jobs done. So I'll just make sure that you pick one, you stick with it, you get that NDA in place, business agreement, and block all the others. Or otherwise, people will use them and not even realize the harm they're causing.
And this is Mike. Just to add on to that, I may not have said this, you know, 5 years ago, but today, many of those cloud storage organizations have pretty robust data security programs in place themselves. It is key, though, that whichever one you choose for your organization, you make sure you choose a business account. It's not just kind of personal or free accounts, which may have different security measures in place.
And this is Brian. The only other thing I would add is make sure you're checking your contractual commitments with clients, because some clients are very explicit about where they will allow their data or not. And I've seen quite a few contracts that prohibit the usage of public cloud. So certainly back to data flow, just follow where the data goes and what type of data it is before you make that decision as well.
And this, Jeremy, again, it's a good point, because I've actually seen scenarios. It wasn't the cloud that was the problem. It was where it was located. When you're getting into healthcare and when you're getting the government, especially, there's usually requirements that you do not store your data out of country or make it available out of country. And I've seen where companies didn't realize that their data was being worked in India or Jamaica or wherever, and it could actually cause not only a breach, but they could be in violation of their terms of agreement. So that is definitely something to check for.
Good advice. Another question in from the audience, multi-tenant or single-tenant solution, does it matter?
This is John, I'll take that one. So, you know, multi-tenant, it's really the discussion between public cloud and private cloud. As other people have discussed, private cloud does come with some of its risks. As long as you have a good contract in place with whatever cloud vendor you're using, then it can be used successfully. Most people in our industry opt for private cloud just for that extra layer of comfort, but it is more expensive. So it really comes down to how well you can negotiate that contract.
Hey, this is Mike. Just to add on to that, so cybersecurity consultants love to tell people, no, you can't do that, it's too risky. But in reality, either one works. It's just making sure that you fully understand the capabilities and the risks that come with that decision.
Okay, excellent. We've just about reached the top of the hour. But because we have a full panel today, what I'd like to do is go around the panel and give each of you a chance to offer any parting words of wisdom, anything maybe you didn't get a chance to talk about today because of where the discussion went, but thought it was important and wanted to bring up, any chance to summarize your thoughts for today, just sort of offer any last words of wisdom, I guess, before we wrap up. Mike Wright, would you mind going first?
Sure. I guess I'd like to just rehash a little bit of what I said earlier about making sure not just that your organization is protected from having these types of attacks be successful in the first place, but also spend a little bit of time on your organization's ability to detect these types of attacks when they do happen. Because, I mean, let's face it, no company is 100% secure. It's, you know, people always say it's always not just a matter of if, but most likely it's a matter of when your organization is going to be breached. And you don't want to be the organization who was breached for 18 months or 2 years or more and not know about it. So spend some time having, you know, either looking yourself, or if this is not your area of expertise, work with a third party to look at your ability to detect these types of attacks and respond to them quickly.
Excellent. Thank you, Mike. Jeremy, you're up.
Thank you, Mike. To kind of build on that, like I said earlier, if you're not an expert, if your job is president and you're not a network technical expert, make sure you have somebody that is. It doesn't have to be part of your company, but a third party that can come in and take a look. And when you listen to what they say, make sure that you mitigate the conversation too, because some experts come in and tell you need everything locked down. Look at what your risk is, where your risky data is at. Look at how you can get as much as you can out of your purview, out of your area. And then for what you do have to protect, make sure somebody can explain to you in layman terms what it is, the risks involved, and what the suggestions are to protect that, and how to monitor it into the future so that you're not just setting it. And a lot of, I find this with a lot of companies, they think that they set it once and then they're good and they walk away from it until something blows up or somebody next to them blows up and they go look at it again. Try to get it into a recurring event, whether it's annual or quarterly or so forth, event that you're reviewing what your controls are and reviewing it with somebody that's an expert that knows about controls and what may need to change or need to be improved upon as you grow or change in your company.
Excellent. Thank you, Jeremy. Brian?
We've talked a lot about, you know, some of the measures you can put in place to reduce risk. But one of the things, and if anyone ever finds themselves in this particular position, you do need to have what's called a good incident response plan in place. So that's how you respond to the particular security events. Make sure that you're looking at client contracts. A lot of contracts have very specific stipulations about notification. So once you know about an issue and if it affects that particular client, what your notification window is to that client. And then the last thing is, for those that either A, have cyber insurance today, or B, don't have it but are looking at it, you need to make sure that you really understand your cyber insurance policy, and that should get integrated in your incident response plan, because there are very specific steps in most cyber insurance policies that you need to follow in terms of reaching out to your insurance carrier about a breach. They usually have a list of very specific resources that you can contact, legal or otherwise, especially on the security side, with doing some sort of investigation. If you do not follow those particular steps, you may not be covered. And a cyber-related event is very costly, especially when you get into the notification.
Excellent. Great. Thank you. Jonathan?
Yeah, thanks, Mike. I would just sum up and say that, you know, we've talked a lot about a vendor management program, and a lot of people have a vendor management program, but a lot of people, I would say, that I've seen don't give it the importance it deserves. So you're really doing a vendor management for every one of your vendors is a very time-intensive task. I would say take a risk-based approach to it. If you've got a vendor that is storing 10 million records of yours, they probably need an on-site visit every year and a long questionnaire. Someone else who's got 10 accounts, you can send them a very, very short questionnaire. Not every single vendor needs to have the same level of oversight.
Good information. And Matt, you get the honor of the last word today.
Jeremy kind of stole my thunder, but I just wanted to add to that. I mean, make sure you're maintaining the culture of compliance and following up on it. And in addition to the breach notification, I mean, under HIPAA, yeah, you may have 60 days to notify your client, but your specific contract and your cybersecurity policy may have different guidelines. In addition to that, your state may have different guidelines. You may have to notify your state AG within 30 days. So be aware of that, you know, each step and each part of those plugins to the process of breach notification, that you're aware of what you need to do and you do it timely and try not to hide anything. If anything's to be learned from, you know, the things we've learned in the last week, you know, you just like you don't want to be notified from an outside entity that, hey, you may have a breach because this is what we found, and then not address it.
Excellent. Thank you. Well, I want to thank Matt, Jonathan, Brian, Jeremy, and Mike for taking the time to participate today. Like I said, on short notice, they came up and really sort of delivered with a lot of great information, and this webinar would not have been possible without their participation. I also wanted to thank InterPros one more time for sponsoring today's webinar. Please go to www.interpros.com to learn about the company. Thanks to everybody who participated and asked questions and spent an hour with us today. One final reminder to take the feedback survey for today's webinar when you get a chance. A recording of this event will be posted to accountsrecovery.net on the webinar recordings page later today. And please stay tuned to accountsrecovery.net for news and more webinars in the very near future. I hope everyone enjoys the rest of the day. Panel, awesome job. Thank you very much. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Mike, for doing this too.
Yeah, thank you.